Well, as most of you know, I like to read, and I like to read lots of things. I like to read stuff, but if I were reading my very favorite thing, it would probably be a biography, and especially of someone that I thought something about their life or something about the choices they make in their life or something about the circumstances of their life displaying the glory of God. And we're in the middle of our series that we're stealing out of Stephen Curtis Chapman's musical CD called Heaven in the Real World. And this week, it's the song entitled Burn the Ships. And if you know anything about an explorer or the explorers that came from the area of Portugal and Spain and other parts of Europe to found and find South America, Central America, and eventually our country, the name Cortez should jump out at you, especially if you're, fourth grade and you're doing the missions report, the California State report. Cortez ought to be jumping out at you. Well, there is an incredible story behind the song Burn the Ships, and I put it in brief form on your notes today, but a guy by the name of Hernando Cortez, in the spring of 1519, he ended up landing on part of the Mexican coast. And what had happened was he came from Spain. He wanted to be an explorer. He wanted to be a high mucky muck in the army. And he ended up teaming up with a guy by the name of Velazquez, I guess it would be pronounced. Anyway, he was in in Cuba. And they had landed in Cuba and set up a Spanish colony, and things were going well, and Cortez wanted to be a hero. So he said, give me the papers and give me the men and let me go and I'll go get the next port kind of thing. And they sailed across the Caribbean and landed on part of what is now Mexico along the coast there. And he landed, when he landed, he only had about 600 men, which sounds like a lot of men, but it really isn't. He only had about 20 horses and some armament. And when he landed, the natives were shocked. I mean, they'd never seen these kinds of horses. They'd certainly never seen armament, you know, bang, bang, big cannons blowing at them. And it wasn't very long until he actually conquered that portion of the coast of, it would be the eastern coast of Mexico. Well, when he got that done, Cortez realized that he had an opportunity to, you know, conquer it for Spain. And he was very loyal to Spain. He was not very loyal to Velazquez, and said when he, you know, put the flag in the ground, this is for Spain, not for, you know, my commander. And when his men saw that happened, there was a bit of an uprising, a bit of an unsettledness, and wait a minute, what about, you know, Commander Velazquez and all that? And he said, no, we're going to stay here, we're going to take the coast, we're going to end up moving inland, all for Spain. Well, his men, you know, turned around and started eyeing their ships. Maybe we ought to get on the boat and get out of here. This guy's got some goals and some aspirations that are not exactly what our military orders called for. And as a means of making sure that he secured his army to continue to march forward across the coastal area of Mexico, he had an order given, and the order was burn the ships. Just burn the ships. And they burnt the ships. And when the ships burnt up, there was no way for his men to retreat. And so they continued their conquest, and Cortez is a well-known name as an explorer for Central America and beyond. When Stephen Curtis Chapman stole that idea, that concept of burn the ships, he wasn't so much talking about the leader trying to make sure there was no retreat on the part of his followers, but more of a statement of commitment. And I think the reason it resonates in my heart so much is that we lack such commitment in our culture. Our culture is a singularly unfocused and uncommitted group of people. And I'm going to spend the next 30 minutes or so trying to convince you of that. And at the end, I'm going to try to say to you, wait a minute, we ought not to be like that. Let's start with some biblical examples. Cortez is a great one out of history, but let's look at some biblical examples of this business of people grumbling and complaining and lacking commitment. And one of the best places to go to is in the book of Exodus. I'm having trouble talking this morning. I'm going to get my tongue worked out here. Let's go to Exodus 14 and start there. You know the story as well as I do. This is the story of the children of Israel being rescued, if you will, by Moses and being led out of Egypt, where they've been under great constraint, to put it mildly, and persecution more specifically. And God has sent Moses along to do his thing and to let his people go. And they get out of there. As a matter of fact, there's the tremendous story of them walking across the water, the Red Sea's parting. And in chapter 13, they're consecrating then their firstborn so that God's glory can be seen, and his people have been led out of out of Egypt towards the promised land. In chapter 14, Pharaoh's in hot pursuit. Okay. Sorry, that'll sound so good on the tape. Yeah. In chapter 14, Pharaoh is in hot pursuit of the Israelites. And it starts in verse 12, the part about the nature of grumbling and complaining and lacking any kind of commitment. In chapter 14, verse number 12 of the book of Exodus, the Bible says this, maybe verse 11, "Then they said to Moses, 'Is it because there were no graves in Egypt that you've taken us away to die in the wilderness? Why have you dealt with us in this way, bringing us out of Egypt? Is this not the word that we spoke to you in Egypt, saying, "Leave us alone that we may serve the Egyptians, for it would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than to die in the wilderness."'" Now, wait a minute. What was their life like before he led them out? It was awful. They were being killed. The babies that were boys were being killed at birth. They were under great persecution. They had nothing. They were even denied the raw materials in order to make the bricks in which they had to toil every day. Their circumstances were disgusting. And yet, at the first moment to have an opportunity to go, "Yes, we're with you, Moses, let's go," what do? They grumble and complain. All right, turn over to chapter 15. Short period of time later, now they're realizing, as they're starting to wander around the Sinai Peninsula, that they lack water. Chapter 15, about verse 24 or so. It says, verse 23, "When they came to Mara, they could not drink the waters of Mara because they were bitter, and they named it Mara. And so the people grumbled at Moses, saying, 'Well, what shall we drink?'" And then he ends up turning around, crying out to the Lord, and the Lord provides water. So they get gone. First thing they say is, "Were there no places to bury us in Egypt? Hello, why are we going out here to die?" And then at the first opportunity to not have a supply, in this case water, they start the grumbling again. Go to chapter 16. Now they're running out of food. Verse 16, verse 1, "They set out from Elim, and all the congregation of the sons of Israel, they came to the wilderness of Sin, which is between Elim and Sinai, on the 15th day of the second month after their departure from the land of Egypt. And the whole congregation of the sons of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness." And what are they grumbling about? They say, "Would that we had died in the Lord's hand in the land of Egypt, when we sat by the pots of meat, when we ate bread to the full. Ha ha, for you have brought us out into this wilderness to kill us and this whole assembly." You know, we make fun of the grumbling nature that we have, but look at them. I mean, they no sooner get set free and they start the process of grumbling. Where is the sense of commitment? Is anybody in their crowd burning the ships behind them in a statement of commitment? Absolutely not. At every turn, they're whining and complaining, which is probably why there are some very specific commands in our Bible that say, "Do not grumble." Look at the two that I wrote down. One in John 6. Jesus actually answers and says to the people, "Stop grumbling among yourselves." You ever been to a party where women don't grumble? Have you ever been to a grouping where there's four or more ladies and it doesn't get off on some sort of a grumbling? I mean, it's part of our nature. We no longer say, or we don't have to say much more than, "Hello, how are you?" And boom, here comes the first complaint. And it's either about our family or our children or our husbands or our work or our circumstances or our car or our something. It is very much a part of the human nature. And it's that grumbling and complaining that eats away at any kind of resolve that we have. One of the reasons our marriages are not built up is because we don't build them up. We get together and whine. You don't get together with your girlfriends and talk about how wonderful your husband is. Typically, we get together and bite at them a little bit. One of the reasons our kids don't have the self-esteem that maybe they should is because we see all the negative. And there's plenty of it, heaven knows. But if we want our kids to have any kind of positive element, we need to build them not up, not pick them down. In a work environment. Yeah, you know, in our office, it's awful, it's terrible. Why is it awful and terrible? Because the only thing talked about is the not-so-good stuff. When was the last time you heard a secretary extol the virtues of her boss? It doesn't happen very often. And because of that, Jesus comes right out and says, stop grumbling among yourselves. And in Philippians chapter 2, Paul gives us a little instruction in verse number 14. Do everything without complaining and grumbling. Because when we're complaining and grumbling, we have no commitment. When Cortez's men turned around and realized, ooh, he's setting up a little deal here that doesn't include our commander, and I'm not sure I want to hang around here and be a part of this, and whoa, big jungle over there, and hey, maybe it's time to go home. It all started with grumbling and complaining, and a lack of commitment let them turn ready to go run into the ships, and had he not burned them, the whole conquest would have been over. There is a time and a place for us to understand that grumbling must stop and commitment must begin. And that's the thrust of all this. So one of my questions to you and I is that why do we in our culture lack such commitment? We have disposable marriages. We have disposable jobs. We have disposable cars. Everything in our world is disposable. If we don't like our church, we go find another one. If you and I lived 100 years ago in, you know, Iowa, and we were believers, and we went to church on Sunday morning, if the pastor preached something that we didn't like, or Sister Sue said something that we weren't happy about, we didn't take our marbles and go across town. There wasn't another church across town. Everybody went to that church. In South County, how many churches have you been a part of in the last 10 years? We have disposable churches. Oh, now I've gone to meddling, right? It's true. We don't like our church, we go somewhere else. We don't like the store, we go down the street. In the olden days, you didn't like the store, too bad. It was the store. But today, you don't like Vons, go across the street. You don't like Ralph's, go across the street. You don't like that Vons, go to the one that's down the street. There's another Vons. Disposable. Why do we live in such a community or a culture that lacks commitment? First off, it's because everything in our culture is relative. Everything is relative. Our answer to any kind of a demand or any kind of an expectation, any kind of a request, what comes out of our mouth if we think it's going to cost us anything is, well, that depends. Can you help us out with such and such and so and so? Well, that depends. What does it depend on? Well, circumstances, my availability, what's going on in my life. Our culture is so relative. Everything is relative to something else. There's no blacks and whites. There's no I believe in this and I'm going to stand for that, which is what the lesson was about 3 weeks ago. We just have a very, well, yeah, if it works out, yeah, try, maybe, well, yeah. Somebody said to me not too long ago that Stony Brook had less volunteers than we did 10 years ago. And I think there's an element of truth to that. There are more moms that are working earlier. You're trying to pay down mortgages that are biting at you that are worse than maybe 10 years ago, and so more people are going to work quicker. But the truth of the matter is we have about the same amount of volunteers, and you've heard the old adage that 20% of the people do 80% of the work. That is true in every area of our culture. It's true in church, it's true at school, it's true in your social activities or clubs that you might be a part of, service organizations. 20% of the people do 80% of the work. And if you want something done, you go to the busy person. You don't go to the one that's got all the time. Because the busy person is committed. They have an element of commitment. And it's a focus. It's not relative. To the unbusy person, everything is relative. Well, if it works out, well, my friend doesn't show up, well. That's our culture. We lack follow-through or lack commitment, and we lack a degree of involvement because it always depends on something. It depends on our circumstances. It depends on our mood. It depends on our perspective. Mrs. So-and-so, do you tithe? Well, yeah, if we're not in a financial bind. Wait a minute. You know, can you do so-and-so? Well, yeah, if I get up early enough. Well, yeah. It doesn't cost me too much. Can you look at a very silly thing? This is a very silly thing, but it's so emblematic. We got an activity at school. We need cookies for the school activity. Where do the cookies come from? They come from Vons. They come from Ralph's. How many of our parents actually get up in the morning and bake the cookies? And if you said to them, we really like home-baked cookies, they're going to go, well, that depends. That depends on my schedule. That depends on, that depends, that depends. You know, in the old days, and I'm not saying the old days were perfect. They certainly had their issues as well. But the level of commitment was different. We lack follow through. We lack commitment because it always depends on something. I was reading some very interesting statistics, if you will, and information about divorce. It was very saddening, actually. But a particular website called, it represents a book apparently called The Divorce Racket by a guy by the name of Rosenblatt. But anyway, in the midst of the discussion of this particular book, he says, and I'm quoting now, that the average men spend more time, or average man spends more time deciding upon a car purchase than in choosing a lifelong spouse. And the average woman often knew more about her hairdresser than about the man she intended to marry. Now, that's just a comment from him, but it's undergirding this more than half of our marriages end in divorce. And I'm not on a divorce kick, so I got my eyes closed. I can't even tell if there's been somebody that's divorced. I'm not on you about divorce. I'm just saying it's emblematic of this lack of commitment. If men spend more time deciding what car to purchase than they do investing in the lady they're going to marry, we got a problem. One of the other problems about why we lack commitment is this whole business about we don't cherish truth. Truth is that which is true for all people at all times. There is very little that our culture would say is true for everyone at all times. It's all a relative. Nothing stands on its own. Nothing has its own personal integrity, or very little. We have very disposable duties. At a different time, our culture might have looked at a downtrodden aspect of our culture and say, we have a responsibility to care for that person or that group. But in our culture today, we go, he can't get a job? Why is that my responsibility? The prodigal sons, not prodigal sons, excuse me, the parable of the guy who by the road is beaten and left alone, and three guys go by, two of which are religious leaders, and they leave him alone. And finally comes along one of the outcast groups, the Samaritans, and he stops and helps him. That is so emblematic of our culture.
Well, couldn't he help himself? Couldn't he get a job? Why didn't he have a job? I have a job. I'm busy.
That is how our culture responds. 50% of our marriages are ending in divorce. 50%! You talk about disposable relationships. Listen to a couple of statistics that have to do with this whole issue. In 1997, 50% of the population were married. In 1990, 7 years before, 62% of our culture was married. 20 years before that, in 1970, 72% of our culture was married. We have dropped almost, what would that be, 20-some percent, almost 20% in 27 or so years of our population standing up and saying marriage is important. Another one, the median age when they first got married and when they first got divorced. The median age for men to first get married is almost 27 years of age. You want to know when their first divorce happens? 3.5 years later. Which suggests to me that marriage is, on average, lasting 3.5 years. The percentage of people who have been married to reach their 25th, their 35th, or their 50th anniversary, less than a third make it to their 25th. Less than 20% make it to their 35th, and about 5% make it to their 50th. And they're living longer and longer and longer. 5% of our marriages actually make it to 20 years. And we're all going to live past probably 75. Most of you got married somewhere in your 20s, but of course we're getting married later. But my point is still 5% make it to 50 years? It's disposable. It's not committed. We no longer take vows and keep them. Think of something for which you had to take a vow. I sat and thought about this for a while. Vow. Marriage? That would be the one. Can you think of anything else where you've taken a vow? If you took an office, you know, an elected office, you're going to put your hand in a Bible and you raise your right hand and I promise, da-da-da-da. Maybe if you're a juror or you're giving a witness in a law case, you might make a vow that you're going to tell the truth. What else? We're a culture without promise. We don't make promises because we don't want to keep them. There are very few vows. And I went into God's Word and said, wait a minute. The culture that's held up as an illustration to us in the Bible is full of vows. They make promises all over the place. And they make an effort to keep them. The definition of a vow in the Scripture might be a solemn promise or a pledge. A pledge that binds somebody to a specific act and they have to behave in a certain way. It's almost as if you went next door and said to the person when they moved in, hello, my name is, I'm your next door neighbor, and I promise to be a good neighbor. I'm making a solemn vow we're not going to throw trash over the fence. I promise that we'll turn the news down at, 10 o'clock. My kids will not throw balls into your backyard, or if they do, you can just throw them away and we'll get more. A solemn promise to be a good neighbor. That doesn't happen. How about a solemn promise to be a good employee? That doesn't happen. A solemn promise to be a good parent. When we take our children to church and we allow the pastor to bless them and to say as a kind of a dedication, I dedicate this baby to the Lord, that's a solemn promise. That's a solemn promise that we'll perform something. It's a pledge. That's one of the reasons I really like baby dedications. Not for the baby. There's no heebie-jeebie thing that happened to the baby. But what it is mom and dad are standing there saying in front of their culture, I make a pledge. I make a promise. I'm going to be this kind of parent. We need vows that move us to that sort of thing. In the Bible, the vows were always voluntary, but once they were made, it had to be performed. It was not optional. And I gave you several illustrations of the kinds of vows that were made, and they're in lots of different circumstances. The first one in Genesis 28, this involves good old Jacob. And he needs God's blessing because his dad sent him out to find a bride, and he's kind of in scary time, and he has a big vision. And in chapter 28, it comes to a point where he says to the Lord, I'm going to do these things if you'll just bless me. It's conditional in that he's driving to get God's blessing, but it's also a commitment. I'm going to do these things. There are vows throughout our Bible. In Psalm 116, I gave you an illustration of when God did bless someone, they vowed to serve the Lord. In Psalm 61, it showed up as kind of an everyday vow. Every day, getting up and making a commitment to God. And then in 1 Samuel 1, it highlights the special kinds of vows at festivals or feast days. One of the things you might consider doing with your children is on their birthday, repeat your vow. Repeat the vow you did on the day you dedicated them. Take that little darling and stand in the living room, put your arm around him in front of your family and friends and say, I say again, I am committed to being a godly mom. I am committed to being who I'm supposed to be in God's Word. I'm committed. On your anniversary, to set your husband aside, look him in the face, put your hands on his cheek, and repeat your vow. Say it again, I'm committed. They had vows regarding money. I've got my possessions, I've got what I need, God, and I make a vow to you. They had lots of vows about marriage. In Numbers 30, just turn there for a second, the book of Numbers, chapter 30. The actual word in my translation, which captures the Hebrew word, is vow. The law of vows in chapter 30. Lots of different kinds of vows. But he starts off with the ones about marriage. Then Moses spoke to the heads of the tribes of the sons of Israel, saying, this is the word which the Lord has commanded. If a man makes a vow to the Lord, or takes an oath to bind himself with the binding obligation, he shall not violate his word. He shall do according to all that proceeds out of his mouth. Also, if a woman makes a vow to the Lord and binds herself by an obligation in her father's house in her youth, and her father hears her vow and her obligation by which she has bound herself, and her father says nothing to her, then all her vows shall stand, and every obligation by which she has bound herself shall stand. Now again, I am not on a hunt about those of you that have experienced divorce or are in the middle of it. I understand it's a complicated and difficult issue. I'm just saying here's one of those examples where as believers we could make a difference by maintaining our vows. George Barna a few years ago did a study, and there's been some argument about the validity of his study. But in that study he concluded that those of us who call ourselves evangelical, born-again type Christians, we have divorces as often, if not more so, than other groups. In his study, he said, for example, in the Jewish community, 30% of the folks have been divorced. In the agnostic or atheist community, 21% have been divorced. And in the born-again Christian evangelical group, here we go, 27% have been divorced. All that says, and you can argue about the stats, but all that says is we're not much better at keeping vows than anybody else. And that's a problem. That's a problem, and it requires us to burn some ships. There were other kinds of vows regarding our children. 1 Samuel, when Hannah has her baby, she makes a vow, a big vow about that baby. Turn to 1 Samuel chapter 1. She is into this child. 1 Samuel chapter 1 and verse number 11. And she made a vow and said, O Lord of hosts, if thou wilt indeed look upon the affliction of thy maidservant and remember me and not forget thy maidservant, but will give thy maidservant a son, then I will give him to the Lord all the days of his life. And here's an example of how you'll know I'm following up on my commitment. A razor shall never come on his head. That was one of the signs and symbols that such a commitment was made. They shaved their heads. We don't keep commitments, much less let the community know we have one. That's part of our problem, is we don't say it out loud. We don't say it repetitively. We don't review it. We don't renew it. That's why I'm saying on birthdays and anniversaries, you ought to have an opportunity to renew a vow. There are whole groups in the Bible that make vows regarding their whole lifestyles. We talked about the Rechabites a few weeks ago in Jeremiah 35, a group of people who said, "Hey, we're not going to live in the city. We're not going to build homes. We're not going to plant vineyards. We're going to be nomadic people, totally dependent on the Lord." And the fact that we don't seek permanence is one of the ways the community will know that our focus and commitment is on God. We as a culture tend to put down roots so deep it's not funny. We got to have permanence because we're scared and we lack trust in our Savior. It's that fear that makes us want the permanence rather than the Rechabites saying, hey, we'll live nomadically because we trust our God. Another group that has some vows regarding lifestyles is the Nazarites. And I gave you some places in the Bible where you can look them up. They wouldn't drink wine, which meant they were down to water and goat's milk as far as liquids were concerned. And they had a physical shaving of heads so you could spot them in the crowd. And you knew they were a Nazarite because they never grew their hair out. They always had it shaved. It was a way for them to stand out of the community. How do we stand out? In your neighborhood, when somebody drives down the street, how do they know that there is a godly family in that house? If we look the same and act the same and celebrate the same and have the same lifestyle and same choices, how do we stand out? The Nazarites stood out. The Rechabites stood out. Godly people ought to stand out. Now, I don't think you should go shave your head. I'm not pushing for shaved heads. Although, if you have somebody that has cancer, it's a great thing to do. But I'm not suggesting you shave your head. I'm suggesting that there be some other means by which vows are taken seriously and people see it. We also don't understand and certainly don't apply any kind of principles of what I'm going to call covenant living. Covenant living. You know what a covenant is? The Bible talks a lot about covenant. It comes out of a Hebrew word, berith. And berith means to fetter, to tie up. And it came to also mean to have a meal with, to eat with. Now, why would it mean to eat with? Because the idea in that culture was, if you had people that ate with you, you had a mutual commitment to them. There was a covenant relationship. For example, in the Old Testament, if you were traveling from point A to point B, there were no inns. You didn't stop at Motel 6. It didn't exist. Or Marriott or whatever you stop at. But anyway, those didn't exist. If you pulled into town, what you did is you went to the well. And you stood around the well a few minutes until somebody showed up to get water. And as soon as the first person showed up to get water for their community, you would be invited to their home. No ifs, ands, or buts about it. Because there was no way for you to sustain yourself in traveling in that culture if you weren't readily welcomed into someone's home. So to eat with someone suggested covenant kind of living. We have a commitment to each other. Even though I never met you before, you showed up at the well, I showed up with my bucket, I was going to get water, there you were, come on home for dinner. It was part of the covenant way that they lived, connected to each other. The Old Testament is full of covenants and full of this binding together. Now, what makes a covenant special is that it's an agreement between either two people or two groups of people that involve a promise. Not just a passing comment, but a promise. I promise to do whatever. And that Hebrew word berith means I'm fettered because of that promise. I'm tied. I'm connected. There is a sense in which I must fulfill that covenant. Now, the difference between a contract and a covenant, our culture has contracts. We got contracts coming out of our ears. You can't rent a car without signing your life away. I had to rent a car this last weekend. Barb's car is dead. My car died Friday night. We were a household with no vehicles. Dennis, please, can you go get her? She's on the freeway, dead. So I had to go rent a car. I had got my car to the place to get fixed, and we had no vehicle, and we had a very important weekend. I had tickets to the UCLA game. Anyway, so I had to rent a car. High priorities in life, you understand. So I went to rent the car, and I have the insurance deal that covers, you know, however many days of rental. So I'm standing in Enterprise, and the guy goes, "Oh, Miss World, nice to see you, da-da-da-da. I see you're driving a Explorer. Would you like," and he names this fancy SUV. I said, "No, thank you." Or I said, "Well, actually," I said, "does my insurance cover that?" And he said, "No." I said, "Okay, then I just want what my insurance will cover." "Well, for only $5 a day, you can upgrade to the whatever." I said, "No, I want what my insurance will cover." "Well, for only $3 a day, we could upgrade the da-da-da." "No, I want what my insurance will cover." "Well, you've been driving a SUV. You really want to be in a rinky-dink car?" I'm quoting, "rinky-dink car?" I said, "Yeah, I'm in love with rinky-dinks. Give me my rinky-dink." So he, you know, runs out the contract, you know, 6 pages long. And I am not kidding you. I said, "No thank you to the insurance, because I have insurance that covers rental cars. I rent cars fairly often. I understand the process. I don't need the additional insurance." So I said to him, "No, thank you." He said, "Well, you know, no, thank you, no, thank you, no, thank you." I am not kidding you. When he handed me the actual contract, I had to sign my name 3 times and initial 6 times. I mean, we are a contract-laden society. We have a contract for everything. You get a newspaper, you sign a contract. But we are lacking covenants. A contract, by definition, has an end date. I rented the car for 1 day, I turned it back in the next day, I'm finished with that. It's an over and done with issue. But a covenant never ends. It's a permanent arrangement. That's why marriages should be looked at as covenants, not contracts. Prenuptials, what are those? That's just when we bust up, and we will. This is how we'll distribute our whatever. A covenant says, I am permanently fettering myself to this issue, to this cause, to this person. And that's why our Bible is full of covenants. A great Bible study for you is to look at all the places where there is a covenant expressed. And there are 2 kinds of covenants. One is where both parties agree to the covenant and they are equally bound. The other is what's called a one-sided covenant, where the one party says, I'm going to do this regardless of what you do. Now, the two-sided covenant says both of us are going to perform in a certain way. And there's some examples of that. Turn to Jeremiah 34. Look at an example. Jeremiah 34, the old weeping prophet. He's in the middle of a prophecy against Zedekiah. And in chapter 34, verse number 18, he starts describing a covenant. Let's see, verse 18. And I will give the men who have transgressed my covenant, who have not fulfilled the words of the covenant which I have made before me. And then he says, when they cut the calf in two and pass between its parts, the officials of Judah, the officials of Jerusalem, the court officers and the priests and all the people of the land who pass between the parts of the calf, and I will give them into the hand of their enemies because they broke their covenant. Now, when you had a covenant in the Old Testament and 2 parties came together to make this covenant, what they do is take a certain animal or animals and cut the animal literally in half. And they'd lay the animal on 2 sides, 2 halves of the animal here. And the 2 parties that were making the covenant would walk through the 2 cut portions of the animals. It was a physical sign that we too are making this covenant. I promise X, you promise X, we both pass through the cut pieces of the animal. And of course, what Jeremiah is saying here is, you know, God's keeping his end of the bargain and you're not keeping yours. But it's an example of cut animal, 2 people walk through, we make a commitment. Which is essentially what you're doing in marriage. Which is the idea of the goodie over the top. Of course, that has symbolism in a cultural sense too. But it's the idea that together we both join in and we both say, yep, we're keeping this. Now, in the Old Testament, a one-sided commitment, or a one-sided covenant rather, would be God keeping his part and making himself accountable, and the other party not being able to do that. And a great illustration of that is in Genesis 15. In Genesis 15, This is between God and Moses. Excuse me, and God and Abraham, not Moses. A little early for Moses. In Genesis 15, God has selected Abram, and he has promised Abram a son. This is a commitment, a covenant relationship between God and Abraham. He's going to bring him into the promised land. He's going to make him the father of many nations. It's the start of his covenant relationship with Israel, which is repeated to Jacob and on down through the line. So this is the first time this shows up. Let's see. Let's start in about verse 5. And he took him outside and he said, look toward the heavens and count the stars if you're able to count them. And he said, so shall your descendants be. Now, Abraham is what? 99 at this point. His wife's ancient. They've had no children. And God's promising him he's going to be the head of a very large nation. Then verse 6, he believed in the Lord and he reckoned it to him as righteousness. And he said to him, I am the Lord who brought you out of the Ur of the Chaldees to give you this land to possess it. And he said, O Lord God, how may I know that I possess it? How do I know we got a covenant going here? And so he said to him, you bring me a three-year-old heifer and a three-year-old female goat and a three-year-old ram and a turtle dove and a young pigeon. And he brought all these and he cut them in two. And he laid each half opposite the other. But he did not cut the birds. And the birds of prey came down upon the carcasses. And Abram drove them away. So it sounds like, it looks like it's going to be a two-party covenant. They're going to come together. Both of them are going to walk through. Verse 12. But when the sun was going down, a deep sleep fell upon Abram. And behold, terror and great darkness fell on him. And God said to Abram, know for certain that your descendants will be strangers in the land that is not theirs, where they will be enslaved and oppressed 400 years. But I will also judge the nation whom they serve, and afterward they will come out with many possessions. As for you, you shall go on to your fathers in peace. You shall be buried at a good old age. Then in the fourth generation they'll return here, for the iniquity of the Amorite is not yet complete. It came about when the sun had set that it was very dark, and behold, there appeared a smoking oven and a flaming torch which passed between the pieces. What's Abraham doing? God's put him to sleep. He's not a part of that covenant. It's on God and God alone. What the other party does doesn't matter. God, in the presence of this flaming torch and an appearance of some smoke, he passes through, and verse 18 says, on that day the Lord made a covenant with Abram. Now my point is that covenants were serious business. And in this particular case, a one-sided covenant, whether the other party went with it or not. We often let our covenants go because we say, but he didn't. Well, they're not. How come I'm the only one who... That's my favorite line. How come I have to be the one to be the big kid when he or she isn't? Well, God put himself in the line with his covenant relationship all the time. And he put himself at risk, not the other party. He knew Abraham was going to... What? He lied about his wife. She's my sister. Never met her before. What a reliable guy was he? God knew Abram wouldn't be able to stay up to the bargain, so he made a bargain on his own character. And what I'm suggesting to you is that covenants are important, whether they're two-party covenants or one-party covenant. You may stand up in your family relationships and say, I can't control him. I can't control them. I don't know what they're going to do. But me, I'm passing through the cut-up chicken because I'm keeping my covenants. I'm standing for what's right. Go take a chicken, cut it in half, sit it in the middle of the living room. No, that'll make it smelly. Go in the kitchen. Put it on the floor. Don't eat it later. Just put it on the floor. And pass through. Laugh your full head off while you're doing it. Wouldn't it be better, though, to be a people of covenants, people of commitments, even if we have to slice the chicken up and throw it on the kitchen floor? All right. We don't do this because we lack commitment. We lack the understanding of covenant living. By the way, what was the sign of a covenant? The sign of a vow was shaving of head. What's the sign of covenant living? Circumcision. Circumcision. Serious sign. You know? It was a serious commitment. And it was something that cost them an issue. It was painful. It set them aside. When Israel's men showed up wherever it was they were going, and they were circumcised and the rest of the men at the restroom were not, they stood out like a sore thumb. They were physically so different. There was no question that they were Jews because of the circumcision. Now, what do we have? In our culture, how can we stand out? I don't think circumcision is the answer, but again, some physical sign, some means for people to look and say, ooh, there's a believer, probably by virtue of decisions we make and lifestyle issues. In Genesis 17:11, he says they're to undergo circumcision, and it will be the sign of the covenant between me and you. You and I need to find the covenant signs, whatever they might be. Let me give you a third thing that I think is true as to why we don't have this kind of commitment to life, is we don't esteem duty. Duty is not a vocabulary word that shows up very much anymore. We have jobs, we don't have duties. Do we have duties? We have duties, guys. The Bible is full of duties. That's responsibilities. That's not something for which you get paid. That's something you got to do. And you do it because you're in a relationship with other people. And according to the Scripture, we have duties to all kinds of people. The first one I thought about was to the poor. That passage in Leviticus talks about if you owned land and you went to, you know, reap your crop, and so you came out to, you know, to pick off the strawberries or whatever it was you were growing, you left the edges of the field unpicked. You say, well, wait a minute, I got 5 acres, I need to pick all my 5 acres. No, you picked 4 acres, for example, and you left the strips on all sides alone. Well, why would you do that? Because the poor needed to have a way to have a livelihood. And so everyone who had a field picked the whole field except for the edges to make it easy for those that were poor. And the folks that were poor, it wasn't a shameful thing. They just came and picked the edges of every field, and their needs were met. The person who owned the field had a duty to those who don't. When you and I pass someone begging on the street, our first impulse, at least mine has historically been, why didn't he get a job? Look at those tennis shoes. Where did he buy those? Those shoes look better than mine. Or some other whatever. The Bible talks about a duty to the poor. We have a duty to our spouse, and there's scripture for you there. You have a duty to your neighbors. And it's not just the person that lives on your right and left, but it's people in your community. Christians ought to be the first people to meet the social needs. You know, I'm a red-blooded, to the right of Genghis Khan political kind of person, you know? And I think everybody ought to get a job, and everybody ought to work hard, and, you know, my mental picture of society is just to the right of Genghis, you know, over there. But the truth of the matter is, one of the reasons that the other party often looks more Christian is because they have a social conscience. And oftentimes we don't. They care about unwed mothers. They care about this aspect of society or that aspect of society. We ought to be the first people supporting homes for battered women. We ought to be the first people that are supporting and helping orphanages. We ought to be the first people out there with soup kitchens and means of supporting those that lose jobs or whatever. The cry against believers is that we're lazy, and we put a little wall around our little church community, and we don't look outside. Covenant living says, hey, you stop by, you hit the well, I'm the first one there, I bring you home. We have duties. We have a duty to our government. It is so in vogue right now to hate your government. There are so many responsible passages that talk about our responsibility to our government officials. It's not funny. We're supposed to pray for them and assume they're being used by God in our lives, whether we agree with them or not. We have duties. We have responsibilities. We have a need to keep our vows and to live within covenant living. So my point to you is, it is literally time to burn ships. I don't know where you are in your life situation, but you ought to look at some of those areas where you're lacking in commitment, or lacking in promises, or lacking in keeping your word, or lacking in moving in through society with a sense of duty, and burn some ships. Say, I'm not doing that anymore. I'm going to be a reliable person. I'm going to keep my promises. I'm going to keep my vows. I'm going to live covenantly. And when we do that, then the burning of the ships is no big deal, because we're not going to go back anyway. In fact, that's what he says in the words of his song. It's kind of interesting. He says, in the spring of 1519, a Spanish fleet set sail. Cortes told his soldiers, this mission must not fail. On the eastern shore of Mexico, they landed with great dreams, but the hardships of the new world made them restless and weak. And quietly they whispered, let's sail back to the life we knew. But the one who led them there was saying, burn the ships. We're here to stay. There's no way we could go back. Now that we've come this far by faith, burn the ships. And spiritually, wherever you are, you ought to be burning ships. I'm not going back. I'm not taking the easy road. I'm not sliding back into a previous lifestyle or previous kind of mindset. I'm going to make some commitments. I'm going to take my heel and drag it across the sand and say, that's where I am. I'm not going back. Whether it's a choice of a behavior or an attitude or a commitment, I'm not going back. I'm going forward. I'm burning the proverbial ships. And we need to do that as it relates to our marriages, and we most definitely need to do it as it relates to our commitment to Christ. So I want you to listen to the song and see where you need to burn your ship.